This podcast has never had ads or sponsors, thanks to the incredible support from our Patreon community. If you want to support independent space journalism, go to patreon.com/universetoday. Astronomers find 128 new moons for Saturn, 4 mini-Earths orbiting around Barnard's star, a new video from Blue Ghost One, and massive science budget cuts for NASA. In our Patreon version, a bonus story about the return of the X-37B spaceplane. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. Saturn and Jupiter go back and forth with who has the most moons in the solar system. And it really just comes down to how good are our ability to observe Saturn and Jupiter here from Earth. And just yesterday, astronomers dropped a massive new number of moons for Saturn, 128. Now, let's just be clear about this. This is 128 new moons, not 128 total. This brings the total moons at Saturn to 274 moons. And this is almost more than the rest of the solar system combined. So how did they find this many moons? Astronomers use the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, which is in Hawaii, and observed Saturn for multiple years. And then they looked through all the data that they had and searched for any objects that were shifting from frame to frame. These are the moons. I'm not sure you would call them moons exactly. They are objects that are kind of like comets or asteroids, about a kilometer to 2 kilometers across, but there's a lot of them. And it's thought that these are the results of the fragmentation of a larger moon, or maybe impacts between other objects together, or comets that were captured by Saturn. And the astronomers don't think that they're going to find a lot more moons at this point. We're really reaching the very limitations of what Earth-based telescopes can do. All right, your move, Jupiter. 4 mini-Earths around Barnard's star. Barnard's star is the closest single star to Earth. So while the Alpha Centauri system is 2 stars with Proxima Centauri, Barnard's star is next, and it is about 6 light years away. It's a red dwarf star with about 16% the mass of the sun. You can't see it with your eyes. You'd need a telescope to know where it is. And yet, because it's so close, astronomers have been studying it, looking for exoplanets. Now, there aren't any transiting exoplanets, which means like they don't pass directly in front of the star from our perspective. But astronomers have used the radial velocity technique to find one planet and a couple of other candidate planets in the past. And the radial velocity method, this is where the gravity of the planet is pulling on the star in such a way that you can actually just measure the change of the frequency of the light coming from the star as it moves back and forth. But it's very subtle, and so requires a lot of observations, requires a very powerful telescope. And so astronomers used the Gemini North Telescope, which is also in Hawaii, and they observed Barnard's star for 112 nights. And they used a brand new instrument on the telescope called Maroon X. And this is an instrument that specializes in this radial velocity method. They're able to watch and measure the spectra of the star and detect any of these changes. And they were able to confirm the original exoplanet that was found years ago. They were able to confirm some of the other candidates that astronomers had suspected, and they were able to find a fourth planet. So now we know that there are 4 planets orbiting around Barnard's star. Now, these are considered mini-Earths, so they probably have about 20 to 30% the mass of Earth, and they are orbiting very close to the star within a couple of days. So they're inside the habitable zone, but these have been found. So it could very well be that over time, as more observations are made, then we might find more planets farther away. But for now, the closest single star has 4 planets. How cool is that? All right, I'm going to give you some updates on some lunar missions. First, the good news, and that is Firefly Aerospace's Blue Ghost 1. And I actually showed you a video last week of Blue Ghost 1 using its PlanetVac instrument to scoop up, suck up samples of regolith from the surface of the moon. A lot of people ask me, how can you have a vacuum on the moon? And obviously, when you're in vacuum, you can't have a vacuum on the moon. And so they actually have to blow gas so that they're able to then drive particles into their collection apparatus. And the goal here is that, you know, a lot of the really interesting scientific targets around the solar system are going to be in this kind of environment where you want samples of the regolith. And so this experiment will test out these techniques so that maybe When we have missions going to other asteroids, other places, the moon, Mercury, and so on, maybe we can collect these samples. And so the new video to share is from the subsurface thermal exploration with Rapidity, or LISTER, which is weird for as an acronym, because it's not like, anyway, it's not a cool acronym. And this is designed to drill into the regolith. So far, it's down about a meter, but it's ideally going to end up about 3 meters down. And you can see how the regolith is kind of cracking and popping and chunks are falling out as the drill is moving down into it. And the purpose here is to measure how geologically active is the moon. How much heat does it have still inside? It will be able to measure how the heat changes from one depth to the other, and that will allow geologists to calculate how much heat is still left inside the moon. And the next big event that's coming up is that on the 14th, we're going to have a total lunar eclipse. And so the moon is going to pass into the Earth's shadow. Now, we see that here on Earth. We see as the moon gets chomped out, and then eventually the whole thing turns red, you know, the blood moon. But from the perspective of a spacecraft on the surface of the moon, it will see this red ring around the atmosphere of the Earth, like an unlimited number of sunsets all happening at the same time. And so hopefully we will get these images of a lunar eclipse from the perspective of the moon. And we're going to be able to see this full moon here in North America. And so I'm going to try to live stream the whole thing when it starts. So stay tuned. I'll put an event on the channel here so you can watch that. And now the bad news, and that is the Athena lander, which came from Intuitive Machines. And as you probably know, it landed hard on the surface of the moon, fell over sideways, and wasn't able to get any power into its solar panels. And we've got a little more information about what happened. There's a really interesting picture you can see of the surface of the moon that was taken from space. And you can see at the very center of this image, there's a tiny little crater. And in that tiny little crater, you can see the lander. It had the bad luck of landing inside this tiny little crater. It fell over onto its side. So it's in the dark inside the crater. Its solar panels are blocked from the sun. And so it didn't last long, sent one image home, a little bit of data, and now it's offline. Last week in the comments, a lot of you noted how it felt like it was a very top-heavy lander, but they had sort of tried to redesign it to be as bottom-heavy as possible. It really looked like they had a very unlucky landing spot. They definitely had a problem with the laser rangefinder, which was designed to help it find a nice, safe, suitable landing spot and make sure that it was the right distance and moving at the right speed. That happened with the first lander, happened with this one as well. Probably the next version is going to try to have much better artificial intelligence to choose a landing site that is safe. So hopefully the Intuitive Machines 3 mission will be successful. Every week we do a vote on our channel where you tell us what you thought was the best space news of the week. And the winner this week by a landslide was Firefly's Blue Ghost landed on the moon. So thank you everyone who took the time to vote on the story. Now we put the new poll into the post tab here on YouTube within about 24 hours of when this episode comes out. So if you're just scrolling on YouTube and you see the poll, go ahead, take a second and vote. Tell us what you thought was the best story of the week. Of course, the best chance to see that is to be subscribed to the channel, click on the notifications bell, and then just obey the algorithm. Okay, so here's the story that I have been holding off talking about for as long as I could, and I cannot hold it off anymore. And that is that we're now starting to learn what budget cuts are coming to NASA as part of the current administration's budget cuts across the government. So it hasn't gone into place yet, but the plan seems to be that the administration is going to cut the science budget for NASA by about 50%. That would take it from its current financing levels back to about its 1984 levels, which are close to the lowest amount of funding that NASA science has had. And it's important to sort of understand what is affected by this. So you've got the human space exploration, you've got its work on aerospace and other spin-offs, and then there is the science directorate. And that includes both Earth observations, climate change modeling, as well as missions, James Webb, Curiosity rovers, all of those missions that are in the pipeline. And, you know, we don't know what a 50% cut to NASA's science funding is going to be, but it can't be good. You're going to see cuts to existing missions. You're going to see cuts to future missions, that the amount of science that NASA is going to be able to do is going to be dramatically changed. And just yesterday, we learned that the science director of NASA has been let go. And so I'm not sure if that they're going to find somebody new for that position or whether they're just going to shut that position down entirely. So, you know, this is what's coming. And then when this is actually implemented, I'll be able to give you a much better sense of exactly which programs are being cut and how things are going to have to be rearranged. Now, we're still waiting for the new NASA administrator, Jared Isaacman, to come on board. He's waiting for his Senate confirmation, which should happen pretty soon. And so hopefully once he comes on board, once they put out some information that tells us what the plan going forward is, I'll be able to keep you updated. But, you know, this is catastrophic for NASA science. Remember asteroid 2024 WIRE-4? We could visit it. So hopefully, over the last couple of episodes, I've relieved any anxiety you have about asteroid 2024 YR4 striking the Earth in 2032. The chances of that now have been scaled down to like 0.001%, although there could be a chance that it hits the moon. So okay, we don't have to be worried about YR4. But maybe WIRE-4 should be worried about us. And that's because people are still thinking about how they could do a mission to this asteroid. So there's a new paper where some scientists look into some possible architectures for missions that could rendezvous with WIRE-4. You could get a flyby, you could get an orbiter, and you could even get a sample return mission. And obviously, this is a fascinating object for us to understand because, you know, although it's not a threat in 2032, it's still in our vicinity. And so it could end up crashing into Earth sometime far in the future. And when this asteroid makes its closest approach to the Earth, the gravity of the Earth is going to make it shift its trajectory, could change the shape of the asteroid as it falls into our gravity well. And by having a spacecraft with it, that will give us a much better understanding of like, what is the composition of this asteroid? How does it deform and change as it gets close to the Earth? And so this is the kind of thing that would be a priority. And so YR4, you got our attention. Now we're going to follow up. All right, it's time for some pictures. First, this is the Flame Nebula. And for those of you who are amateur astronomers out there, this is a very familiar object. It's located in the constellation of Orion. You probably have seen the Great Orion Nebula, but this is one of the other nebula that is in that region. Same thing. It is a giant star-forming complex with huge clouds of gas and dust that obscure your view. And it gives this very cool flame look that you can see in a small telescope and definitely if you can take pictures. But this picture is from James Webb, and James Webb looks through the gas and dust to see the objects that are underneath. And of course, it's a star-forming region, so there are knots of stars located inside this nebula that you wouldn't be able to see without infrared. In fact, in the science paper that goes along with this image, astronomers said they saw red dwarf stars forming, they even saw brown dwarfs and large Jupiter-like objects. And so there's a lot going on inside these star-forming regions. And then the second picture is a young star called LIND 483. And it's not just one star, it's a binary star. So you've got two stars that are orbiting around one another. Both of them are brand new and fresh. They're still pulling in material from the stellar nebula around them and then putting those into accretion disks around the stars. And then as the stars rotate, their magnetic fields interact with the accretion disks. And so you get these twin jets that are coming off of the stars, and they're overlapping as the jets are going off in this perpendicular direction from their rotation. And so this image comes from James Webb, and so you're able to see through the gas and dust that would obscure this kind of an object and reveal the underlying formation as it's going on. And we know that there's a lot of complex organic molecules that are coming together in these clouds. These are the kinds of things that turn into the amino acids and the other kinds of hydrocarbons that we find here in the solar system. We're really learning that the building blocks of life were formed in these stars as they were coming together. Now, while you're watching this week's Space Bites, I am working on my weekly Guide to Space email newsletter that contains many more stories that you're not going to see here. For example, you can watch the sun unleash a solar flare. Is Europa alive? A laser could detect biosignatures from space. And then finding white dwarf main sequence binaries with Gaia. I send out the guide to space every Friday. It goes out to 70,000 of my closest friends. It's completely free. There are no ads. Like, there's no ads on anything now. Am I right? Every word. So check it out. Go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. Did you know that you can watch the same video with no ads and get a bonus story over on Patreon completely for free? And this week's bonus story is all about the X-37B and its completion of its seventh flight. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm going to talk a little more about some of the projects we're working on, our new big announcement, and so on. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. A special thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew M. Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, Brian Boddy, Caredwin, Cy Nelson, David Giltonen, David Matz, Dustin Cable, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hans Schultz, Hudson Moore, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Lawrence Federico, Michael Purcell, Paul Robach, Ren Kaidu, Robeck, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler Munley, Thomas L. Skadron, Vlad Shiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. So we had a big week. Hopefully you've seen the sort of big announcement that we had, the Leap of Faith video about how we've decided to shut off all of the advertisements on Universe Today and go 100% supported by Patreon. And the response has been overwhelming. And I now feel incredibly confident that that was the right decision to make. And I really look forward to this clean, ad-free existence, just focusing on leading a team of space journalists. Thank you, everybody who has already supported us, both by joining our Patreon, as well as the kind words and the support, and even all of the technical support on how to run better backups. It's all appreciated. The second thing, and you better hurry, and that is that we're going to have this lunar eclipse in a couple of days. So the eclipse starts on Thursday, March 13th at around 9 p.m. Pacific time. So that's going to be midnight for people in Eastern time, and then it's going to be early morning for people in Europe, but it's only visible to the Americas. And so I'm going to live stream the eclipse from the telescope setup that I'm able to use thanks to Starfront. So I'm going to put an event here on the website, but hopefully if you're watching this, you'll still have time to be able to come and join me to watch the moon be destroyed and then come back. All right, we'll see you next time.